Hi, listeners. If you love Undisclosed, I have two small favors to ask you. First of all, please support our sponsors because they support us. Check out their great products and services using the unique Undisclosed codes and URLs that we provide every week so that we can keep coming back to you week after week. And the second favor I'd like to ask you is this. I am so excited to announce that Undisclosed has finally launched a Patreon page. Now, if you've ever wondered how you can support our work, this is finally one way you can do so. You can become a patron of Undisclosed for as little as $5 a month. All you got to do is go to patreon.com/undisclosedpod and sign up there. Check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/undisclosedpod.
If you believe the state's case, Dennis Perry is someone who is both incredibly violent and incredibly racist. He is someone who shot down two people in a church because he saw an opportunity to satisfy not only his desire for revenge over a petty slight, but also his desire to find out what it was like to kill a black person. And he is also someone who is cold and calculating enough to get away with it for 15 years. You haven't heard from Dennis Perry yet in this podcast, and my hope is that one day maybe you will. For now, though, Dennis Perry can't speak for himself, which means any sense of what kind of person he was and is has to come from others. And those who have known Dennis Perry will tell you the same thing. There's nothing they've seen about Dennis Perry that would make them think he was possibly capable of committing these crimes.
This is totally, totally not him. I just do not believe, and I will always believe, he had nothing to do with this.
That's Karen Perry. She didn't know Dennis at the time of the murders at Rising Daughter, but she met him only a few years after. And for 13 years, she was Dennis's wife.
Like I said, he was a happy-go-lucky guy, always laughing, always the jokester. He would have done anything for anybody. He'd give you his left arm if you needed it. He was a giving person, a loving person. He was a good guy.
In this episode, you'll hear about what Dennis Perry was like from the viewpoint of those who were closest to him, both before and after his arrest. And you'll hear about what happened to him and what his life was like after he was charged with the murders of Harold and Thelma Swain.
But before he got convicted.
We were great. We had a good marriage. I mean, like I said, we were just starting to build our dream, our home, everything. And it was all taken away.
Welcome to Undisclosed. This is episode 12 of the series of The State versus Dennis Perry. My name is Rabia Chaudhary. I'm an attorney and author of the New York Times bestseller Adnan Story, and I'm here with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Epton's Prof Blog. One of the most important things we do for our health every day is brushing our teeth. Yet most of us don't do it properly. Quip is a better electric toothbrush created by dentists and designers. Quip is designed to make brushing your teeth more simple, affordable, and even enjoyable. I've been using Quip for over a year now, and there's two things I really like about it. First, like most people, I used to brush too hard, and my electric toothbrush was too abrasive. Quip solves this with sensitive sonic vibrations that are gentle on your sensitive gums. Second, like 3 out of 4 people, I used to use bristles that were old, worn out, and ineffective. Sometimes I would use the same toothbrush for over a year. With Quip, brushes are automatically delivered in a dentist-recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5. That's why I love Quip and why they're backed by over 20,000 dental professionals. Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/undisclosed, you can get your first refill pack for free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack for free at GET. QUIP.com/undisclosed.
I really believed he was framed. He was picked. And there's just no way he could have done it. It just was not his character to do something like this.
Karen never doubted his innocence, but she and Dennis needed to find a way to prove his innocence to everyone else, and most importantly, to his jury.
So when they told me that what was going to happen, they're going to go to trial and they were going to seek the death penalty. At that time, they told me I was going to need two attorneys. I would need one from Jacksonville and one from Georgia. And that's when, and Dale and my dad knew each other. My dad had retained him at one point, sometime in the past, and recommended that I give Dale a call and see if he'd take the case. And I had to come up with a retainer fee. I think he was only asking off of me for $25,000 just to retain him, and wasn't anything to do with the Georgia lawyer. So we came up with $25,000 for Dale, and the families had to get together. We had to pull all our resources together and did what we could do to try to help. We didn't want him going in there with a public defender. We wanted him to have two attorneys that have been through this and could possibly get him out of it, you know.
After Dennis Perry's arrest, the family had scraped together $25,000 to retain Jacksonville-based attorney Dale Westling as his lawyer. And when that money ran out, Dennis Perry was declared indigent, and Camden County became responsible for paying the bills of both Dale Westling and also Georgia attorney Ed Clary, who acted as local counsel on the case. At the time, Karen and the rest of Dennis's family had thought Dale Westling had been a good choice.
Westling handled a capital case before?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you know how many?
I don't know, but he said, but all the cases, he's never lost a case, is what he told me.
So lost any case?
Like any case to do, like
what? Any capital case.
Yeah, any capital case.
In the years since, though, no doubt colored with the hindsight of the case's outcome, many of Dennis's family members have come to have a different opinion on their attorney selection.
And I started saying, you're going to need a lawyer. And then they got Karen's daddy's lawyer, and that's who Dale Westling is, an idiot.
As far as Dennis's brother Daniel remembers it, Dennis's attorney just sat on the case for 3 years and then waltzed into court unprepared.
He was supposed to be this great lawyer, and Dale was the worst man we could have ever got. He did not care about that case. Mm-hmm. His daughter lived up in Atlanta, so the only time he would try to do something was when he was going to visit his daughter. He'd spend an hour, you know, trying to talk to us about something, and then that was it. And that was the only time he actually worked on Dennis's case until it came up to trial, as far as I was concerned. And when that happened, you know, he wasn't ready. And he was supposed to be this great lawyer.
Karen Perry, who was much closer to the trial preparations, saw it differently. Dale Westling did do a lot of work, she said, at least at first. And she was in regular contact with him, extremely regular contact. If you hadn't known that Karen Perry was Dennis Perry's wife, based on the references to her throughout the defense file, you probably have assumed her role had been a paralegal from the firm who was dedicated to the project.
Dale pretty much kept me updated. And I was tell you what, I stayed on his behind, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, after a while, and I'm not just saying this with attorneys, but after a while, I think it's with the case growing stale, through our investigation on our, you know, the attorneys that I had, it just kind of got stale, and they just seemed to start putting things on the back burner, like, you know, they would take their time about it. Like, in the beginning, it was like, oh, you know, they jumped right in on it. But it seemed like after a while, they just kind of grew stale with them or something.
3 years would pass between Dennis's arrest in 2000 and his trial in 2003. And for 3 long years, Karen visited Dennis every moment she could, which wasn't very many moments at all.
I went up there every weekend, every Saturday. Every Saturday to see him for a 30-minute visit.
After his arrest, Dennis Perry had been moved from Jacksonville to Camden County, and from there, for his own safety, to Glynn County. That's where he was for most of those 3 years.
Our visits were, like I said, 30-minute visits. We had glass partition between us. We had to talk through phones. There were times where he absolutely felt totally alone, that nothing was moving quick enough. And that's always the case in the court system. Everything goes slow.
And that's always the case, but it's still...
But for 3 years, do you sit up there for 3 years? That's ridiculous. I've never heard of a town keeping somebody in a county jail for 3 years.
I still don't understand why it took that long. Do you know why it took so long?
No, I'll never know. I don't know. I know they don't do these things like this here in Jacksonville. They move you in and move you out pretty quick.
The delays weren't due to the fault of any single party. Sometimes it was the state slowing things down, and sometimes it was the defense team. And sometimes it was just a result of the way the court's calendar was structured. But the end result was that Dennis Perry wasn't even arraigned for over a year after his arrest. And it was 16 months after his arrest before the state began handing over discovery. And some of the delays seemed to have been caused, in part, by something of an assumption on all sides that this case would be resolved by a plea agreement and wouldn't be going to trial at all. But that never happened.
In August of 2002, Dennis's attorney sent him a letter outlining the history of the plea negotiations in the case to date.
Dear Dennis, this will acknowledge the following. You are currently charged with 2 counts of murder in the first degree. The maximum penalty is death as to each count. I have told you that based on the facts of the case, a conviction would, in my opinion, result in a sentence of death. I have told you that the case has an odds picture of approximately 60-40 our way. Thus, I believe that we have a slightly better chance to win than the state does. Approximately 3 weeks ago, John Johnson called me and gave me an offer. He said that in exchange for a plea of guilty, the state would recommend 2 life sentences. I presented the offer to you and you rejected it. I recommend that you not accept the offer.
The next offer that came in from John Johnson was 15 years. Dennis Perry turned that offer down too. As described in Westling's letter,
I called Johnson and told him you would not take 15 years. Early last week, Johnson called and told me that he would take 12 years and reduce your charges to voluntary manslaughter. The law in Georgia would require you to serve 90% of the 12 years or 130 months. You would receive credit for 32 months already served. You would thus have 98 months remaining. On Saturday, August 24th, 2002, Ed Clary and I met with you in jail and presented you with 2 plea agreements. We suggest that you sign one for 10 and one for 12 years. It was our strongest recommendation that you accept this proposal. Frankly, we felt that it was an offer that should be accepted. We strongly advise that you sign both plea agreements, give us authorization to present the 10-year proposal first, and to then present the 12-year proposal if it was rejected.
And again, Dennis said no. He would not give authorization to his attorneys to accept the deal. But Dennis's attorneys kept trying.
Ed visited with you during the evening hours of August 26, 2002, and presented you with 5 plea agreements. He asked you to sign one for 4, 6, 8, 10, and 12 years. We then intended to present them one at a time to Johnson, with the smallest term being presented first, to be followed by the additional term if Johnson was not willing to accept our initial offer. You rejected Ed's advice and told him you would not sign a plea agreement.
Because Dennis Perry would not follow his attorney's advice, they were now asking him to sign a letter confirming his rejection of the plea deals.
Based upon the charges that are pending, this plea agreement is incredibly good and should be accepted. I cannot stress enough my advice that you accept this plea agreement. Again, you have chosen to ignore my advice and that of Ed Clary. You have elected to proceed to trial. By signing this letter, you'll acknowledge that all of the statements referenced herein are true and correct.
Dennis signed the letter. He wouldn't agree to take any plea. It's not that he didn't know the risk of doing so, that it might lead to his execution, but as Karen remembers it, it was what the plea deal would require that, for Dennis, made the plea bargain not possible. A plea bargain would have meant a plea colloquy, and would have required him to give a factual statement of how he'd done the crime.
That's the part he turned down, because he said, and I remember him saying it, I'm not going to tell a lie to God. I'm not going to lie, get up there and lie and tell these people that I did this, that I'm guilty when I know I didn't do it and I'm not guilty.
I was so thrilled to find out about this next sponsor coming on board to help sponsor Undisclosed, because I actually have been using this company, their products, for a couple of years now. I'm talking about Zulily. I love Zulily. In fact, there was a time when maybe I loved it too much. I felt a little bit addicted to it. I can't even tell you, when I was pregnant and expecting my son, I did all of my shopping before I had him on Zulily. I bought adorable clothing for him. I have bought really unique pieces for myself. I've gotten amazing shoes and bags and you name it, perfume. I have bought everything. I bought all kinds of things from Zulily, dresses for my daughters. I love Zulily, and I love it mostly because it's an app. It's on my phone. It's so easy, and the items are really unique. And every day at 6 a.m. Pacific time, Zulily announces deals on all new items from boutique brands and big labels, like, for example, Cuisinart, KitchenAid, Spanx, all up to 70% off. You know how they do it? Well, you purchase what you want, Zulily places one big order, they get the item, they mail it to you. They save money because they're not storing things in warehouses, and that helps keep the prices low. And that also lets them offer deals on everything from apparel for you to interactive personalized toys, even home decor. I've bought stuff for the house. You can shop for essentials or plan ahead for special occasions. Fresh, curated selections make it really easy to find great gifts or throw an awesome party. See for yourself why over 6.5 million members shop on Zulily.com. This month only, our listeners get an extra 20% off your first order when you sign up at Zulily.com/undisclosed. Once again, that is this month only. You get 20% off your first order when you sign up at Zulily, that's spelled Zulily.com/undisclosed. Zulily.com/undisclosed.
In Dennis's legal files, amid all the transcripts and legal filings in discovery, there are also personal letters and notes tucked here and there, correspondence that Dennis Perry has sent and received over the past 18 years after his arrest. And in those letters and notes from the first 3 years, when Dennis was awaiting trial, you can see traced out the slow progression of his case as it moves forward to trial, and how he and his family grappled with the situation, trying to come to terms with what had happened. Some of the letters date back to not long after Dennis's arrest. In those early notes, you can see the family's utter faith that this situation was only temporary, that it was all just a colossal mix-up that would be rectified soon. Like a Hallmark card from Dennis's sister-in-law Tamara that must have been written sometime in 2000. On the outside, there's a little mouse struggling to lift a barbell, his feet not even reaching the floor, with the message, "It may not always be easy." And when you open it, the card says, "But I know you will make it." And the message from Tamara written there inside is just as cheerful and optimistic as the card.
"Hey there, Bubba. How's it going? Good here. Daniel, so glad to see you and talk to you. Sorry they wouldn't let me in, but I'll see you soon enough, because it won't be long now. You just remember to keep your head high and not let this little bit of time get you down. We're going to use our house as bond if we need to, and you can be at peace about getting bond. They have to give it to you now. Love, Tamara."
They did not, in fact, have to give Dennis bond now, and they didn't. There are also lots and lots of letters from Karen. Karen wrote to Dennis all the time, telling him about how much she missed him, about how her day had gone, giving him updates on the latest episodes of The Amazing Race and how her favorite teams were doing, and how much their dogs and their parrot Squeaky miss Dennis too. In one letter to Dennis, Karen wrote,
"I love you, Precious, and I'm so proud of you, of how strong you've been through all of this. There are not enough hours in the day for me to give thanks to God how much I'm so thankful he brought you in my life 10 years ago. You are my best friend. Well, sweetie, I gotta finish getting ready. I know who holds our hands together. I love you, and Pootie loves you too. I'll see you in the morning. Karen."
Karen's letters are also useful to us now in investigating the case because they help to reconstruct what was being done and what wasn't being done at various stages leading up to Dennis Perry's trial. Karen kept close tabs on everything being done, and she updated Dennis regularly. For instance, in one letter she wrote,
"Hi, babe. Just sitting around watching The Amazing Race. Team Cha-Cha just got put out. They crack me up. Anyway, I'm going to see defense investigator John Bradley in the morning. I am going to go over a few things with him. These latest interviews from the GBI, all this stuff, is very good for us. I'm going to make you copies and you'll get yours in the mail Monday, probably along with this letter. Good reading material. Next time you talk to Dale, you tell him, my wife is tired of repeating herself trying to get certain things done, such as this interview with Peggy Barentine, Greg Barentine's sister, who lived with the wild man Leon Avery. It's the little things like this that could bring us answers we need. I found my letters that Dale Wessling wrote to Mr. Bradley last month about finding Peggy Barentine. I'm going to take them with me and confront Bradley at the pass.
Or in another letter from March 2002, Karen wrote,
Dear sweetie, hey, how are you doing? I got up early this morning so I could drop you a line or two. The night before, I couldn't sleep until 3 in the morning. My mind was racing and my adrenaline was kicking in after I read some more interviews done between Duff Kittrell and Butch Kennedy. Donnie Barentine told Jeff, even while they were in jail, who killed the Swains, and that they were armed with pistols. It was what I suspected all along. It all goes back into Brantley County. Well, we are closer than ever now. We are going to catch this guy. By the time you get this letter, I will have seen Dale Westling about all of this. Babe, I love you so much, and God gives us so much strength to get through this. It won't be long now. Soon you will be home.
Most of the letters come from Dennis Perry's papers, which means they're letters that he'd received. But a few of the letters that he'd written were in the files as well. Like in 2002, he sent his little brother Shane a birthday card. On the envelope, he drew balloons and confetti, and the message, Happy Birthday, Lil One. And on the inside, he wrote,
Lil Bro, sorry I can't be there to help you celebrate, but I will be thinking of you. Please don't drink too much, and mind your mom. Happy birthday, love you, Dennis.
And there's another letter in there that he wrote to Karen in late 2001. The letter begins with a salutation, Dearest Pooh, and goes on to tell Karen about what he's heard from his attorneys, which isn't much at all.
Mr. Clary didn't know anything about Dale Westling sending the letter to Johnson or the letter that we had gotten back from Johnson. I think Dale Westling needs to keep more in touch with Mr. Clary more often and use him more. I mean, that's what he's there for. I told him about the letter from Johnson, and he kind of painted me a scenario about what he thought. He said the reason that Johnson said what he said is because they probably got the heat on Donnie Barentine right now, and they have got him sweating bullets. I told him it's about time somebody started working on the stuff that they had had for so long. But I think Dale Westling needs to keep him more informed, because I think he feels left out. I will see you Saturday. Love you. God loves you too. Dennis. P.S. Mom told me that you sent Dale some email giving him what for. You go, girl.
There's only so much what for that Karen could give to Dennis Perry's attorneys, though. And there was nothing she could do about the state's delays and the slow production of documents to the defense.
And even the stuff the state did hand over, it came in a form that was as inconvenient as possible.
How was it organized? How was it?
It was a mess. I mean, just packs of paper. I mean, just files of paper. It wasn't anything filed. I mean, everything was just scrambled together. Just notes that were being taken by the lead investigators at the time.
In many cases, it seems like Karen Perry took the lead in how discovery was reviewed and handled.
Dale let me take the stuff home so I could read it.
Did he have a copy?
No. He let me take the stuff home. I took it to work, and I made copies of everything, and I took all the documents back to him. I had a set so me and his mother could do our own little investigation, because she knew a lot of people in Camden County.
Karen gave everything she had into helping Dennis. She was his pit bull, nipping at the heels of his attorneys whenever they seemed, in Karen's view, to be slacking on the job. She was relentless in her emails and her lists and her questions. She did everything she could to make sure that nothing in this case was missed.
Every night I sat down, I got home from work, and went through pages and reading. And all the investigators back then, pretty much everything in there was pointed towards Donnie Barentine.
Karen still remembers clearly what her reaction was to the evidence once the state had, 15 months after Dennis's arrest, finally handed it over.
Well, we sat down and started laying it all out, reading everything, and I'm telling you, everything in there did not point to Dennis. It pointed to Donnie Barentine. All the evidence pointed towards that man. In Marianna, Florida.
Except the glasses and
that
hair.
Except the glasses.
And the hair.
He could have been a second partner. I mean, the real person that did the shooting might have been his buddy. I mean, we don't know. That's what we were thinking. I think two people did it because somebody cut the phone wires in that church. Mm-hmm.
In February of 2003, 3 years and 1 month after his arrest for the murders of Harold and Thelma Swain, Dennis Perry went to trial. The trial was held in the city of Brunswick, in Glynn County, one county over from Camden. Dennis's attorney had sought a change of venue, reasoning that the jury pool in Glynn County would be less familiar with the case. and going into trial for Dennis's friends and family, spirits were relatively high, all things considered.
So they were all pretty confident that he would be acquitted?
Yeah, we all thought. I mean, this was crazy. We all thought he was going to be acquitted.
Karen had met Dale Bundy before, on those times when he came down to Florida to interview Dennis. But until Dennis's trial, she had never met Sheriff Bill Smith.
He's sneaky. And you know, one of the days, and I think it was the first day we got there for trial, I had to get on the elevator. And I had, I remember saying this to him, I was going to school. I went back to school to learn how to investigate cases like this. Yeah, I was doing criminal justice in college. And that was another thing that I wanted to get back because I wanted to learn more about how the process worked so I could help try to get Dennis out of it. I did everything I could on my end to try to help and get him out. But apparently just, you know, financially, I didn't have it. So, and I started learning. I was actually in the courthouse on the elevator. I was alone with Bill Smith, the sheriff. He knew who I was, and he started to drum up conversation with me. I wouldn't talk to him. I just hurry up, get off the elevator. But he noticed the books that I had in my hand, and they were my criminal books. He goes, oh, he wanted to strike up a conversation with me. Oh, you're going to criminal justice school? And I said, that's right. Then I need to learn everything I can about the process, how it's done. That's about all he said to me. Then I got off the elevator. That was the only contact I ever had of him, face to face.
Karen was listed as a defense witness, which meant that she'd been sequestered. So, along with Dennis's mother, she spent that entire week locked away in a room in the courthouse, not knowing what was going on in her husband's trial, just a few doors over. She wasn't even there for the jury's verdict. It was announced so quick that she and Dennis's mother hadn't made it into the courtroom in time.
I remember Daniel going to his mom, and, you know, his mom walked out and looked at Daniel, and Daniel looked at his mom, and she just broke down. She literally broke down, and he had to tell her.
Karen had known immediately what that look meant. Dennis Perry had been convicted. Later that evening, her husband would be spared the death penalty, but in exchange would receive two life sentences and no possibility of appealing his conviction.
Naturally, I was devastated. Really upsetting. I don't believe he did it. If you knew Dennis, he was just a happy-go-lucky guy. He'd give the shirt off his back to you. I mean, he just... I would have known something. I would have seen something or felt something wasn't right in our marriage. And this was at a time we had just bought a house. We just got the business going. Just bought a boat. We were living our dreams. I'm sorry.
You can take a moment if you need to. No rush.
But I do not believe he did this. I believe he's innocent. I believe that the sheriff in that county is as crooked as a snake.
I am a lifelong crazy cat lady. I love cats. I have almost always had a cat. I currently have two little fluff balls. One is Mr. Beans and one is Gringo, and they are adorable and sweet. They're my family. And yes, they have their own social media accounts. I mean, that's how much I love them. But if there is one thing I don't love about them and don't love about having a cat, it's the litter. I hate cleaning cat litter, and I have a nose like a bloodhound. I can smell dirty cat litter from like a floor away. So I was thrilled to discover Pretty Litter. Pretty Litter is kitty litter 2.0. I mean, it's nothing like the old stuff. It's nothing like the smelly, messy, big, huge, monstrous, heavy boxes and bags of stuff that we have to deal with. Pretty Litter, first of all, it's shipped in a small, manageable bag, but that bag lasts you all flippin' month. A whole month. It comes to your door just like that. It's shipped to you. Small, lightweight bag. No more running to the pet store or storing big old boxes and bags of open cat litter that spills over, makes a big mess. And it's got next level odor protection, which is exactly what my overly sensitive odor glands needs. I mean, there's no mess, there's no smell, there's no fuss, there's no dirty clay or compost that's so disgusting to clean up. And the best part about Pretty Litter, if that wasn't good enough, by the way, that it's manageable, it's lightweight, it comes to your door, it traps all the odor, is that it actually monitors your cat's health. What Pretty Litter does is it changes colors to detect underlying illnesses before there's urgent medical care required. So that saves you money, stress, and potentially your little kitty's life. So do what I did and make the switch to Pretty Litter today. By the way, Susan also made that switch by visiting prettylitter.com and use the promo code undisclosed for 20% off your first order. 20%. Once again, that's prettylitter.com, promo code undisclosed for 20% off. prettylitter.com, promo code undisclosed. Karen was married to Dennis for 13 years, but they are no longer married now.
After the trial was over with and he was taken back to Glenn County, back to the county jail, I came up that following weekend, because like I said, every Saturday, that was my time spent Saturday morning, pretty much all day Saturday. He told me, he says, you know, Karen, he goes, I can't let you stay married to me now that we know what's going to happen to me. And I said, oh, we need to think about what we're going to do. And he said, because I need for you to get an attorney and let's go ahead and start the divorce proceedings. So I said, okay. So I did. Drew the papers up. And it was a little while before I actually got them back where he signed them. And we were able to get the marriage, you know. But it took a little while for Dennis to sign them. At one point, I didn't know if he was going to sign them or not. But he did.
Dennis finally signed the papers, and the divorce was final.
Did you want to get divorced?
Not at the time, but when, after he was convicted, I mean, it was the only, it had to be done. And he didn't want me to have a life being married to somebody in prison, sent up for life. That he made the decision to dissolve the marriage.
Do you think that was the right decision?
At the time, no. But now that you look back at everything, in his mind, probably was.
Well, and for you.
But for me, it's hard to say. Hard to say. No one wants to lose their home and their house and business and their husband to something like this. I mean, it devastated me all the time. I stayed by myself. And I couldn't do anything. I didn't want to go anywhere. I was afraid that, you know, people out there knew me and they knew what I went through.
When Dennis Perry was convicted, every part of Karen's life changed forever. She spent the past 15 years building a new life from the one she had before.
I had to move on. I had to get a new job. Well, actually, after all that happened, I ended up, I had to file bankruptcy. I lost everything. Trying to pay them guys And at the same time, my parents, my brother came and helped me move. I moved back home for a little while and stayed with my mom and dad, I think, for 6 months. And So I had to go from moving to out to a new job and all that, all at the same time. And just regroup, you know, try to build, put myself back together through all of this. It was hard, real hard.
Years later, in 2009, Dennis Perry remarried. His wife Brenda is from Camden County, and she's known Dennis for most of her life. But before his arrest, she hadn't really seen him for a decade.
How often was Dennis in Camden County?
I can't remember the year, and I can't remember the day. But I can tell you the day that I saw him. I had just gotten married, and we had bought a place right there on the corner. And there was a little bar right up the road from the store, probably a half a mile, and it was called Island Grove. So my mom and my grandmother and them went up there one night, and that's when Edward was running the bar, him and Leah, Dennis's uncle, Ed, was running that bar. So we went up there, and my husband didn't go. Well, I saw Dennis that night, and he had asked me at some point to take him down to the store to get a pack of cigarettes. So I took him down to the store to get a pack of cigarettes, and I brought him back, and he got out the car, and he kissed me on my cheek, and I left. And I was done then. I was in love. So I went on back home, and I stayed married for 20 years, and he went about his business, you know, and he got married for 13, and now here we are.
Brenda's and Dennis's paths didn't cross again for many years. But Brenda didn't forget about Dennis either. And when her own marriage ended, she decided to look Dennis up again.
I got a divorce in 2007. Uh-huh. And I knew that he was in jail. You know, I knew about what all went on, but I didn't keep track because he had a wife, and I'm just not the kind of person that gets involved. And, you know, that was his life, and I let him live his life. So when I found out that after me and David got a divorce, I went by and seen Nanny, which is his nanny, at the same house where Ed and him live. And I asked her where Dennis was, and she gave me the address. And then I got with Helen, and we got married in 2009.
Most of Dennis's friends and family hadn't seen it coming. Karen hadn't either.
How did you feel when you found out he got remarried?
I was surprised that he did. And I didn't know anything about Brenda. Apparently, he's known Brenda for a long time. How they got together or decided to get married, I didn't know. I don't know anything about that. But I was surprised. Mm-hmm. But I was happy for him. I mean, if he's happy and that's what he wanted, I mean, anything to give him an ounce of hope that he will get out of there. Apparently she's very, from what I hear, is very adamant of trying to get him out of this too.
Karen had heard right though about Brenda. For the past 9 years, Brenda has been very adamant about getting Dennis out of there.
And so I go every weekend. I haven't missed a weekend since we got married. I go every weekend. I go to Mars, as a matter of fact.
Has your husband close by, or?
No, when he was at Autry, it was like almost 400 miles away.
Brenda knows the life she's chosen is a hard one, but her support of Dennis has been tireless. And the case files that Karen was meticulously compiling and keeping guard over have now been handed down to Brenda.
And this was the evidence I didn't know, and I told Dennis, I said, I'm sure y'all had it. This was the DNA on the hair.
Yeah.
Where it said it's not Dennis's. Mm-hmm. So you got that, right? I told Dennis, I said, I'm sure they got it, but I'm going to take it. This was the letter from Butch Kenny that he wrote in reference to Dennis.
Oh.
He sent to the governor.
I have not seen this.
Brenda has a busy life with a house full of family and lots of kids running around who've grown up with Dennis's pictures all over the walls.
Yeah, my grandchildren love him. We have great-grandchildren. And to them, that's his papa. The little girl in the picture, Diamond, when we used to go see Dennis, and she said, we pulled up there one day, and she said, Grandma, she said, what's those wires up there? You know, talking about the razor wires. I said, that's just protection. She said, well, isn't it nice that those people put those wires to keep bad people from getting to our papa? I said, yes, yeah, very nice of them, honey. I never told her any different. She thought that was very nice that people were trying to protect her papa from bad people.
Brenda says that everyone she knows has been supportive of her and Dennis, or at least if they're not, they haven't brought it up.
What do people in the Waverly think about you being married to Dennis Perry? Do you ever get comments about it? Say whatever.
No. Because people know I don't care what they think.
What's
but I've never had any issues with anybody, so anybody that I've come in contact with, the people that I work for, the people that I work with, have been very, very supportive of Dennis and I. And I don't not tell them. If anybody asks me where my husband is, I tell them he is incarcerated. I've never kept it a secret. I've never had any negativity back from it, from my job, from my coworkers, from anybody that I know.
Brenda herself is not one to keep quiet about any negative feedback she may have, though.
And I was like Dennis, I believed in the justice system, but I knew the people that were involved were crooked.
And when you say people involved, who do you mean?
I mean Bill Smith.
In 2012, Bill Smith was running for election again, trying to regain his office as sheriff after being defeated at the polls 4 years before by Tommy Gregory, who is the son of GBI agent Joe Gregory. And while campaigning, he ran into Brenda.
Have you seen him before? Or that?
Bill Smith?
Yeah.
Oh, my life.
So you run to him regularly?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because he said, Brenda, I got a sticker. I'm running for sheriff again. Do you want to get one of my stickers to put on your car? I said, Bill, I wouldn't put your sticker on my doghouse.
Brenda told Bill Smith exactly why she wouldn't be wearing a sticker anywhere.
Bill, I just want to know, how do you sleep at night knowing you sent an innocent man to prison? He said, what? I said, yeah, I'm talking about Dennis Perry. You know who I'm talking about, don't you? Because you helped send him there. Yeah, I know who you're talking about. But you ain't his wife. I said, well, that goes to show you, you don't know everything like you didn't know everything back then. I said, yes, you sent an innocent man to prison. He said, well, he confessed. I said, you got that in writing around tape somewhere? No, I said, exactly. You got nothing. I left, but it didn't faze him.
Brenda knows that Dennis Perry's sentencing agreement means he has no right to appeal his conviction, and his odds of ever being paroled while maintaining his innocence may be slim. But she's hopeful that maybe, finally, something will open up in Dennis's case one day.
Now, I wanted to tell y'all, I know y'all don't know me from Adam's House, but I'm going to tell you that Dennis is my soul. I mean, I love him more than life itself, you know. I mean, when I wake up in the morning, he's the first thing on my mind. He's the last thing on my mind when I go to work. And that's, every minute, it's about him. And I've never, ever loved anybody like I love him. We've never spent an intimate moment together, but he is my whole world. And I just get up and go because I know that the fact that he's sitting there, and I don't care what happens, who has to do it. I'm going to go every weekend because that's the only peace that he has, and I'm all he's got. But he is my world. And he is the most compassionate. He doesn't blame anybody for where he's at, you know? Because we talk about it because I blame people.
Brenda knows that Dennis faces long odds in this case, but forever as long as it's needed, she'll keep doing whatever she can to bring him home.
And that's what he tells me all the time, because I get real anxious and he has to just bring me down sometimes, you know, because he is my sole meaning for life. My soul. It was like the day that I told you about the Island Grove, and when he kissed me on my cheek and I was already married, I knew then that he was my life. But there was nothing I could do about it then. You know, I was married. And that's just the kind of person I was. I had to raise my children, you know. So me and David was married for 20 years, but when we divorced, and we didn't even divorce on bad time terms, you know, it was just time. Once they got grown and we got divorced, I knew then I had to find Dennis. And ever since that day, that's where I've been. I mean, he is my soul life. He's my life. If he never comes home and I have to die alone, he is my soul life.
In 1985, the investigators on this case from the Camden County Sheriff's Department had firmly believed that this was not a racially motivated crime. In 1998, the investigators may have changed, but this belief had not. Dale Bundy did not believe the murders of Harold and Thelma Swain had been racially motivated either.
This was definitely not a hate crime.
But when Dennis Perry was arrested and charged with the murders, the idea that this was a racially motivated crime returned, albeit in a somewhat muted way. At his trial, at least as far as the transcripts show, there was never any explicit reference made to racism. The prosecution doesn't seem to have made any efforts to stress the racially motivated nature of the crime or to prejudicially portray Dennis Perry as a racist. If anything, the absence of any direct acknowledgement by any of the attorneys that race was even a factor in this case feels like a strange gap in the case's narrative. But there was one very direct piece of evidence at Dennis Perry's trial that, if true, indisputably showed that Dennis Perry had been racially motivated in his killing of the Swains.
Well, you know, Jane Beaver had, she gave, you know, like I said, when I listened to this lady talk about Dennis Perry sitting in her house talking about killing a nigger, you know, and then next week, you know, because he asked for money and the person, and he didn't give him any money, and then next week in Thelma and Uncle Harold pops up dead, this is what she's testifying to. This is what she's saying happened in her house.
And when Susan asked Lavinia why she thought Dennis Perry was guilty, she too cited Jane Beaver's statement as one of the two things that stood out to her.
So, you mentioned what you were saying earlier about the Wilson boy?
He was caught, he was let go. That he, how do you say, fell for, took responsibility for the crime. And someone said that he said, said, why did you want to do it? He said, I wanted to know what it felt like to kill a nigger. But that's hearsay or reading or television. But anyway, I was told he said he did it.
Lavinia doesn't remember now where she learned this, but she must have heard it at trial from Jane Beaver herself. But it's the only motivation she's aware of for why Dennis Perry would have done this. And Lavinia isn't alone in this. Gwen Owens, who, unlike Lavinia, had been identified as a witness and so was sequestered from the trial, didn't have the opportunity to hear Jane Beaver's testimony herself, and for the most part had no idea about what had taken place at Dennis Perry's trial. But there was exactly one portion of the testimony she too was aware of. Because at one point, while sitting over in a witness sequestration room, Gwen Owens and the others with her had heard laughter coming from the courtroom. They'd asked about it and been told that it was in reaction to testimony from one of the witnesses. Gwen Owens didn't know who the witness was, but from context, it must have been Jane Beaver. Because what Gwen Owens was told was that the laughter had come in response to a witness testifying that Dennis Perry had told her that he always wanted to kill a black person. The laughter must have been from Dennis's friends and family because they found the idea so preposterous.
But that's not all Gwen Owens knew about the trial. She told me, all we knew was the person they got was convicted. We did know that. Gwen Owens had never known about the rest of Jane Beaver's story, about how Dennis Perry had supposedly asked to borrow money from Harold Swain. And when I told her about it, it was the first time she'd ever heard of it. All she had heard, and all most people I spoke to seemed to remember, was Jane Beaver's story about what Dennis Perry had told her weeks or a week before the murder, that he wanted to find out what it was like to kill a black person. And if Jane Beaver is correct, that would seem to lead to the necessary conclusion that Dennis Perry was himself a racist. Something Dennis Perry's defense team didn't try to rebut at his trial because, well, how could they have anyway? How can you possibly prove that someone isn't a racist? Sure, some people are racist and have no problem making their views known, but there are plenty of people out there too who harbor racist views but are much more circumspect about it, and rarely or perhaps almost never express those beliefs to others. But this idea of Dennis Perry, the secret skinhead, just didn't fit anything I knew or had heard about him. I couldn't find anyone who'd known Dennis while he was growing up that recalled him acting in a racist manner or expressing racist views. Waverly was a predominantly black community, and Dennis Perry had often been the only white kid in the bus when he was going to school down in Camden County. But the neighborhood the Wilsons lived in was fairly integrated, especially by Camden County standards. But if Dennis Perry had ever acted in racist ways, no one there recalled it. And Dennis Perry's friends and family rejected the idea out of hand. It just wasn't even up for debate.
In your experience, has Dennis ever been racist or ever expressed sort of hostility towards black people?
No.
Which is not surprising since that's coming from Dennis's friends and family. But it wasn't just them. Not a single person I talked to in Camden County who had known Dennis, not even people who believed he was clearly guilty, thought of him as being a racist at all.
Well, he never been racist with me.
So he did. Her story is that he just hated black people.
Well, if he did, he never I ain't never seen that side of it.
In fact, with two, and exactly two exceptions, there was nothing I could find anywhere that supported this claim that Dennis Perry had been a racist, and so racist that he'd killed someone just to find out what it was like to kill a black person. The first exception is Jane Beaver, and her story about Dennis telling her just that. And the second exception? Well, until recently, no one really knew about him. In fact, during my first trip to Camden County, Claire and I were talking about how strange it was that he didn't exist.
You know what shocks me, though? There was no jailhouse informant in this case. Like, this seems like a perfect case for a jailhouse informant. Like, it could fill a lot of holes up. Did they never try? Like, why wouldn't you get an informant?
How long was he in jail before he was trial? Before he was tried?
Years. They had to have tried to get an informant, I feel like. It was, the case is crying out for one.
Turns out, they did try. There was a jailhouse informant. I'd like to claim that I'm psychic, but no. Sometimes these cases are just predictable. Later on that week, while talking to Dale Bundy, I'd almost forgotten to ask him about any possible informants, since something in the file I'd seen had suggested they existed. But after our interview, and as we were packing up, I remember what Claire and I had been discussing earlier on the way in, and I asked one more question.
He was in prison for a while before trial. Did you ever look to see if he ever talked to anyone in prison, or if he'd ever...
Yes, he did. In jail.
Who did he talk to?
We didn't use it at trial because the guy would have been impeachable. But he spoke to an inmate in... He had a roommate in the Glynn County Jail. We didn't house him here. Mm-hmm. There was an inmate, and I don't remember the guy's name, but he came to us and said, I want to tell you what Dennis Perry said.
So Bundy had gone out and talked to this guy.
What do you know about Dennis? He said one night he was in his room and a couple of black guys had come in to talk to him. And Dennis had the top bunk. And Dennis came in and they were leaning on Dennis's bunk. And they left. And he said, I hate niggers. He says, I don't like them on my bed. He says, I've already killed two of them, and I'll kill some more if I get a chance. So we called in the GBI, and the GBI polygraphed him, and he told the truth.
Bundy wasn't able to remember the guy's name after so many years, but he remembered talking to him, and he believed his story.
But you found him believable from what you talked to?
Yes, ma'am. And the polygraph was administered by the GBI by a very reputable polygraphist.
Without having anything more to go on, Claire and I weren't sure where to start with finding this informant. But luckily, the very next day, we got a break. We were going through the files in the DA's office when Claire found a folder labeled with a name I hadn't seen before.
Kate Ruffner.
This is him.
Took a lie detector test.
Gregory Trent Ruffner. That was our informant. It turns out, in October of 2000, about 10 months after Dennis Perry's arrest, he'd written a letter to the DA's office about Dennis.
Dear DA Stephen Kelly, I'm writing to you concerning the double murder case in Camden County. I'm a trustee out here at the detention center, and when we change out the laundry and uniforms throughout the jail, I often talk with a lot of inmates. Well, the other night I was reading the paper, and I saw this guy's picture, Dennis Perry, in there saying he was charged with these murders. Well, he had made numerous comments about N-words and what he will do to them. I really didn't pay much attention when he said it, but when I saw his picture and his charges, it struck me that he was real hateful and guilty. I really needed to talk to you or someone in your office about what he said to me.
A week later, Deputy Bundy and GBI Agent Ron Rhodes went out to talk to Ruffner. In his memo, Agent Rhodes wrote,
Ruffner stated he was working the laundry detail in the jail approximately 2 to 3 weeks ago when he entered the cell of Dennis Perry. Ruffner stated Perry asked him if he could wash his blanket in his bed because, quote, N-words keep putting their arms in my blanket. Ruffner advised Perry then stated, quote, I hate these motherfucking N-words. If I ever get the chance again, I'll kill me another one. Ruffner stated he did not know Perry at the time, but as he read the newspaper several weeks later, he recognized Perry's picture in the paper in reference to Perry's preliminary hearing. Ruffner further provided Agent Rhodes with a piece of paper, which Ruffner stated he wrote Dennis Perry's comment down right after he stated it. The piece of paper Ruffner provided Agent Rhodes can be located at the rear of the case file.
There was no piece of paper in the DA's case file, so who knows what it said. But a few days later, Ruffner was given a polygraph, just like Bundy had told us. And there was a page with the results on it. The result? No deception indicated. Then, 5 months later, Ruffner wrote another letter to the DA's office.
Mr. Kelly, I gave a statement and took a lie detector test about something inmate Dennis Perry told me before. Well, last week I was moved over to his side of the jail and I got a chance to talk to him for a couple of days. He told me he killed the black people and it didn't matter because y'all didn't have no evidence. He also told me the drugs he was on. The reason I'm writing this is because when I went to take the lie detector test, the detective in Camden told me to try and see what else I could get out of inmate Perry. So I did what I could. If you think it could help, please come see me. Sincerely, Trent Ruffner.
From the file, there wasn't much indication of what had happened with Ruffner after that. He was listed as a state's witness in their filings, and there are several notes in the DA's file referencing failed efforts to find him and serve him with a subpoena for trial, but there's no indication anyone actually succeeded in serving him. But we do know from Bundy's interviews with other witnesses that back then, in 2000, he'd taken Ruffner's statements as the corroboration he needed to show Dennis Perry's guilt. For instance, in Bundy's interview with Jeff Kittrell, it was Ruffner's story that Bundy was referencing to explain why he knew that Donnie Barentine's confession had just been empty bragging.
We got a man in jail the night we arrested him, made some statements where we're sure he's the man, and as of late, he made some more statements where we're sure we're him.
But according to Bundy, when we talked to him, although he'd found Ruffner believable, the prosecutor had ultimately made the call not to use him at trial.
Jailhouse person, like I said, the reason we didn't use him is that he would have been too easy to impeach. You understand what I'm talking about, impeaching a witness?
He had a long history of...
And it would have tainted our case that we were desperate enough that we would have to use something like that.
Even though Ruffner wasn't brought in to testify at Dennis's trial, I wanted to know more about his story. He was still living in Brunswick, and we had the return address listed on his letters to the DA, so we started with that. And from there, relatives and neighbors helped us track down where he was staying.
Last house on the right.
Excellent. Okay.
But he wasn't home the first time we went, so we tried again.
Ruffner, anyone home?
His mattress wasn't there.
His light's on. Let's try again.
Everyone out.
And tried again.
Greg Ruffner, take 302.
And kept trying. But we had no luck. Between my attempts and the attempts of the GIP interns to contact him, we met not only with Ruffner's family, but also his girlfriend's extended family and various people that were hanging out at his house that we still don't know who they are. All of whom, however, promised to pass on our info to Ruffner and to ask him to get in touch with us. He never did, and we never managed to run to Ruffner himself. Which means, for me, it's looking like Gregory Trent Ruffner is going to be the witness that got away. Because last week, he got arrested on some pretty serious charges. So, while I hate to declare failure on anything, my window of opportunity to hear from Ruffner himself may have closed. But if Ruffner's story is true, it seems like there should be some kind of evidence out there to corroborate it. Because according to Ruffner, Dennis Perry was the kind of guy who'd announce his desire to kill black people to a random acquaintance. And over the 18 years since Dennis Perry's arrest, there's no way he'd have made comments like that just to Ruffner that one time, and no one else ever. So even if I couldn't talk to Ruffner, I could talk to others who knew Dennis Perry from being incarcerated with him, and find out whether they'd ever seen anything to indicate that Dennis Perry was so racist that it would drive him to commit murder.
Oh, he's no racist person.
That's John Lawrence. Susan first heard about him while going through some old family photos with Brenda.
But these are pictures that we had taken since we had gotten married. Yeah. This was his bunkmate for 6 years. This was my best friend, and so they got married. He's home now.
John Lawrence and Dennis Perry were together for nearly a decade in Autry State Prison, and for most of that time, they lived together in the same small room.
Yeah, they were real big buddies, and they would just kind of watch one another's back and just got one another through. You know, Yeah. John was a good boy.
One day, after Brenda and Dennis had reconnected and gotten married in 2009, Dennis told Brenda he had an idea. He thought Brenda's friend Michelle should meet his roommate John Lawrence. Brenda thought that was a great idea too, and efficient as always, she quickly took care of matters.
So you introduced your friend to him to his roommate?
She worked with me. I was her boss, and she was divorced and everything, and I said, Michelle, And she was miserable. Yeah, she's a good girl. I said, Michelle,
hilarious.
Me and Dennis have somebody we want you to meet.
Oh,
so
my
she
God.
Went up there to visit Dennis, or we set it up for her to visit John, and she went up there, and yeah, they got married.
Dennis and Brenda's matchmaking turned out to be a success.
Well, Brenda and I, we've been friends forever, And I was going through a rough time. Had just went through an ugly divorce, and Brenda's husband, Dennis at the time, said that I needed to pen pal John.
At first, John and Michelle only wrote to one another, but things progressed from there.
It was almost a year before I went to the facility. But John and I wrote and talked on the phone and we just communicated. And I fell in love with him through the letters, but it was a year later that I went and met him.
After that, Brenda no longer had to make the weekend drive to Autry alone.
Brenda and I went religiously every weekend. We traveled that 3.5-hour ride together, split a hotel room, and was there every weekend.
Michelle no longer has to spend every weekend making the trip to see John. After 23 years, he was released from prison, and the Lawrences now live together up near Athens, Georgia.
I consider our happiness. I thank them every time I see them. But yeah, they're good people.
Michelle and John both hope that Dennis will have the chance to come home to Brenda one day, too.
Him even being able to, to fall in love with Brenda and to trust her like he does. He would be lost without Brenda. And, that's just who he needs is Brenda, but it took him a long time to open up to her. And we'd sit there at them small tables and, they would just talk, yeah, and cry. Yeah. That's a whole nother world.
John, for his part, had lived with Dennis when Brenda and Dennis met. But he didn't get the same perspective on Brenda and Dennis that Michelle got to hear.
Did he ever, share with you that he was talking to this woman, or?
No, we don't gossip about that. No, you don't do that. They said certain things is off limits. Because, some guys in there,
they look for your weakness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they don't mind whatever it takes to get up under your skin,
yeah.
They'll do it. Even if it's talking to your lady or doing something behind your back. You have to be careful.
John used to always tell me, they had to watch that word vulnerable. They can't come off as vulnerable.
You can't.
Or weak.
You can't.
Yeah.
Which is why, although John and Dennis lived together for years, it wasn't until John was out of prison that he really began to learn about Dennis's case.
When we was in penitentiary, we don't talk about the cases or not. He never mentioned it to me. I heard through sketches about what went on, but as far as me and him coming out talking to me about it, that's one thing we don't do. We don't invade people's privacy. I was there for him as a friend, and anything I could do to help, I did, and vice versa, he did the same for me.
And there were a lot of times that John Lawrence and Dennis Perry had to be there for one another.
They have to survive.
And it was scary, to be honest with you. Like I said, I did 23 years. It was horrible. When I say horrible, I mean horrible. You fight, stabbing.
So even though John and Dennis never much talked about their cases, John believes he knows exactly what kind of person Dennis is. And John, who is a black man, has never once had reason to think that Dennis was racist.
Like I said, me and him was bunkmates for years, so, don't nobody know him better than I do. He's never came off as toward me as a racist. If he can help you, he would. Anything he can do, he'll help you out.
And John Lawrence never heard Dennis Perry use slurs or racist language, let alone anything remotely like what Jane Beaver claimed to have heard.
We all humans, everybody get upset, but as far as when he got upset, as far as that concerned, that never came up. That never happened. He never called nobody out their name. Never disrespect nobody. We always did things together, me, him and I. So, I don't see the racism in him. I don't. Like I said, I've been with him for decades, so a half a decade. I know him better than any of them. He's been down to earth with me. We like brothers, and we still like brothers.
Dennis didn't meet John Lawrence until after his conviction, which was many years after his arrest. But even in his years in the Glynn County Detention Center, during the time when, according to Trent Ruffner, he was looking to kill another black person, Ruffner's statements stand at odds with everything else I've been able to learn about Dennis's time there. And from Dennis's letters and notes from that time period, there are further glimpses into what his life was like then, at the Glynn County Detention Center. One of the letters was written in 2002, and it was a short note that said,
"Hey Dee, I pray that things are well with and for you. Myself, I'm fine. So how did things go at your court date on the 28th?
It ends,
"Well, my brother, this was just a little note to let you know that you are still in my thoughts and prayers. Tell everyone I said hello, and if my boy Scrappy is still there, tell him he's supposed to be keeping in touch with me."
I looked at the man who'd written the letter. He was out of prison now, but just going off the dates I could find, it seemed like he would have been in jail with Dennis at the same time that Trent Ruffner was. And if I couldn't talk to Trent Ruffner, well, maybe I could find someone who could at least tell me what Dennis's life was like at the time he and Ruffner were in jail together. And the letter writer was a black man, so maybe if there had been talk in jail about Dennis Perry's desire to kill another black man, maybe he'd have gotten wind of it. Although, for his note, it didn't seem like he had. So I called him, and he didn't recall anyone named Ruffner, and thought he probably would have recalled a name like that if he had known him. But he did remember Dennis Perry.
Like I said, we were roommates, and we were roommates for a while. I have nothing bad to say about him. I remember nothing bad that he did or anything like that.
Yeah, I just wondered
about no racist remarks or none of that. I don't even remember Dennis ever getting into a fight.
The letter writer and Dennis had never gone into any details about their charges, though the letter writer had known of the murders of Rising Daughter and knew that was what Dennis was in for. But he and Dennis had gotten along.
We even had Bible study together, so, you know. No, I don't see Dennis being no racist, it could have been hidden now. I don't put nothing past no one. It could have been hidden, but as far as openly, no, he didn't do that.
The letter writer had no way of saying what was in Dennis Perry's heart, but as far as his words and actions showed, Dennis just never gave any sign of harboring the kind of racist views that would lead someone to commit murder. And that's why this whole argument is so frustrating. Dennis can't ever prove he's not a racist. That's just not something that's knowable or provable. But if Dennis Perry was so racist he'd been motivated to kill a black person just so he could know what it felt like, I think it's reasonable to expect that some fragment of that racism would have expressed itself on some other occasion in his life. Dennis Perry's friends and family likely did him zero favors with the jury when they laughed at Jane Beaver's story. But I can see why they did now. They laughed because to them it showed, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that Jane Beaver had made the entire thing up. Listening to episode 12 of Undisclosed, The State versus Dennis Perry. We'll have an addendum on Thursday for you, so if you have questions about this episode or the last one, send them to us at Twitter with the hashtag UDAddendum. Methil Telhan is our executive producer. Our logo is designed by Baluki, and our theme music is by Ramiro Marquez and Patrick Cortez. Audio production is done by Rebecca Lavoy of Partners in Crime Media and the host of the Crime Writers On podcast. To find case documents, timelines of key events, and witness charts, go to our website at undisclosed-podcast.com. And episode transcripts are available on our website too, prepared by our transcribing team, Britta Bliss, Erica Fladell, Don Logus, and Skylar Park. And huge thanks to our sponsors for making it possible for us to come back week after week. Don't forget to follow us online. On all social media, our handle is @UndisclosedPod. That's Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And if any listeners out there have information on Dennis Perry's case that you'd like to share, we'd love to hear from you. Please reach out to us at either undisclosedpod@gmail.com or leave us a message at 410-205-5563. That's all for this week, and thanks so much for listening.